Support for WPR comes from the American Society of Landscape Architects Wisconsin Chapter. Dedicated to reimagining the design of outdoor spaces for the well-being of all. Examples at wiasla.com.
Support for WPR comes from the Stevens Point area, offering a variety of getaway experiences. Itineraries and ideas for beer lovers, foodies, outdoor recreation fans, and more are at StevensPointArea.com.
It's a strange feeling to watch friendships fizzle out in real time on Facebook, but that's what this election has brought us to. I have this old college friend. She's named Lisa Schifrin. We haven't actually seen or spoken to each other in years, but we keep track of each other on Facebook. Lisa's a sometime GOP speechwriter and a conservative columnist, so besides posting about her kids and her dog, she also, as you'd expect, posts a lot about politics. Lisa's got strong opinions, and I often disagree with her, but I like knowing what she thinks, and I like the way she makes me think. But something about her Facebook feed started changing a few months ago. I noticed a different tone. The comments and the replies people were posting seemed sharper and angrier. People talked about being unfriended or needing to block old acquaintances. And it got me wondering, how did we get to this point?
Your voice sounds exactly the same.
I know, so does yours.
It's probably the one thing that doesn't change.
It takes me straight back. So I called Lisa. I got her into a studio to talk about this political incivility, which she says has actually cost her friendships.
More online friends than real friends, more distant friends than close friends. But the funny thing is that it's not so much friends across party lines as, as a Republican and a conservative. The people who are never Trump versus people who are willing to vote for Trump, regardless of what they may think about him as an individual, that's where the huge friction is in my universe.
Really? Tell me more about that.
We've, had endless rounds of, I'm principled and you're just interested in power. And in a few cases, you get tired of it because you don't actually care enough about the person on the other end. And you just say, okay, bye.
So this makes me sad because the thing that I remember about Lisa, the thing that drew me to her back in college, is the way her mind works. She's a really clear, analytical, rigorous thinker. She's somebody you can argue ideas with, or at least we used to, in a way that felt intellectually engaged, but never personal. So it was unsettling when she told me that there are times now when she no longer feels comfortable sharing her thoughts in public.
When I go to places that are not explicitly conservative, I don't bring up politics unless I have some reason to. Maybe it's different if you live in Texas. I'm sure it is. Maybe it's different in the South. But certainly in a place like New York City, no conservative goes out of their way to start these fights because you're a minority, an ideological and intellectual minority. And so much of what we see is not, it's not rational discourse. It is confirmation bias. And it's impossible to actually have a serious conversation where people argue towards some new understanding. I don't see a lot of people changing minds.
So you're saying that you feel, as a conservative, that the cultural sea that you live in is antipathetic to your values?
Very clearly. Not only do I think that, but, my children go to a private school in New York City. And I know all the other parents who are conservative, and I know the Republicans who are not conservative. And not only that, I know the 5 faculty members and 10 administration members who are remotely sympathetic.
That's interesting. I don't know anything about the politics of any of my kids' teachers.
Okay, well, I only know this because at some point or another, if you are this kind of, minority, there's this little signaling thing that happens. I mean, it's kind of like any secret society. A French teacher sidled up to me after a middle school graduation and said, I just want you to know, I'm with you. I'm kind of more of a libertarian, but I'm not a liberal. And I just thought that was the funniest thing in the world. He's a French teacher. Who cares what his politics are in theory? But he needed to say that, and I was happy to hear it.
So there's a feeling that you've got to check out somebody's political ideology before you open your mouth, because otherwise
only if you want to be safe about politics, and especially in a year like this when it's so inflammatory.
Do you have friends who are liberals?
Of course I do. I live in New York. I do. And I spent a lot of time with them the last few months? I most certainly have not. I've tried very hard to avoid all social interactions because I can't.
Why?
I don't want to fight with these people, and they don't want to fight with me. And, you know, at a certain point, it just gets so fraught that there's no point. Here's a funny thing. A couple of weeks ago, I was thinking, well, after the election, I'll have dinner with so-and-so. And then I thought, Jesus, after the election, one of us is going to be even more upset, and it's probably going to be me. So maybe I won't have dinner with her this fall.
Well, see, that's what I'm wondering. You know, if we've gotten to the point in this election that friends are avoiding each other until afterwards, how do we all come back together again, you know, individually as friends and then in the larger body politic?
Well, you know, I think that's a profound question. And I think the issue between friends is less important in some way than the national issue. I think we are at a point where there is such a rift that it's very hard to imagine that the fabric will hold. You know, I'm not one of these people who thinks there's a civil war ahead, but I certainly think that, you know, this 50-50 bifurcation has become so deep and is about things of so much actual serious import in the nature of governance and the rule of law and what we think a government is entitled to do and how big it ought to be, that, you know, I think we really are approaching a point where there's a fissure and it's going to be very hard to leap across it.
What about for you personally? I don't know. Let's say Hillary wins. How long before you're going to feel like you can have dinner with your liberal friends?
Well, it depends. The ones I actually care about. Sooner rather than later, and the ones who are, you know, I don't know. You know what? I do think that with some of these people, things will just dribble away, and they won't mind, and I won't mind.
Lisa Schifrin is a conservative columnist, a former GOP speechwriter, and a friend. And here we are, a divided country. I'm Anne Strange-Hampson, and today on To the Best of Our Knowledge, we're asking a simple question. After November 8th, where do we go as a country? After weeks of fractious campaigning and divided politics, is it possible to reconcile, to restore political civility? Well, for guidance or inspiration, I thought maybe we could turn to the nation's founders. I mean, they kept it together. They hashed out a constitution and created a country without savaging each other, right? Well, Paul Aaron is a historian who works for the Colonial Williamsburg Foundation. He's got a different story to tell. The title of his book says it all, Founding Feuds, a story of bitter rivalries and intense conflicts in the early days of the Republic. It turns out the Founding Fathers could be just as vicious and just as scathing as politicians today.
The insults that they had puts us to shame. It is so much more scathing and so much more eloquent. One of my favorites is Thomas Jefferson writing to James Madison about Patrick Henry, and he summed it up by saying, what we have to do, I think, is devoutly to pray for his death.
Oh!
Or you have Abigail Adams on Alexander Hamilton. I have read his heart and his wicked eyes many a time. The very devil is in them. Or this one. I mean, George Washington liked to generally stay above the fray, and most people were afraid to attack him. But Thomas Paine wrote to him, said, "And as to you, sir, treacherous in private friendship, for so you have been to me, and a hypocrite in public life, the world will be puzzled to decide whether you are an apostate or an impostor, whether you have abandoned good principles or whether you ever had any." I could go on.
Well, you know, for those of us demoralized by the bitterness of this year's election, it's kind of reassuring to discover that not only were some of the founders' feuds just as bad, but in many cases they also managed to reconcile.
And Adams and Jefferson, for instance, they began as friends, and then they ran against each other twice, which seemed to destroy their friendship, to such an extent that the last time, when Jefferson won, Adams left Washington, D.C. on the morning of the inauguration, and he never came back. But near the end of their lives, they somehow became friends again.
As with so many of the founders' feuds, there is a happy turn. In 1812, Adams sent Jefferson a New Year's greeting, and Jefferson responded warmly, and that unleashed a flood of letters, 158 between 1812 and their deaths on July 4th, 1826. And that's a story that's been told many times, but I can't resist mentioning it.
It's just so
amazing that they both died on the 50th anniversary of the adoption of the Declaration of Independence. In their letters, Adams wrote, "You and I ought not to die before we have explained ourselves to each other." And boy, did they explain themselves to each other and also to us. I mean, they talked about philosophy, they talked about politics, as if their differences had never been personal. Mm. Jefferson wrote back to Adams, "We do not think exactly alike. Matters little to our country, which we have delivered to our successors." And I think Jefferson was certainly right that they didn't think alike, but he was wrong that it doesn't matter to us. Their letters are a testament both to their feud and to their friendship.
Well, that's lovely. But, you know, then there was also the most famous feud between Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr, which ended with Hamilton dead. I was actually trying to think what a contemporary equivalent would be. Someone said it would be as if Joe Biden shot Condi Rice. Is that a fair analogy?
It's a completely fair analogy. I mean, this was a duel between the former Treasury Secretary and the Vice President. So, yes. Rice is the former Secretary of State, not former Treasury Secretary, right. But the analogy is absolutely apt. I mean, given how vehement these duels were, how nasty the words were, in one sense, it's remarkable that there wasn't more bloodshed.
After that, Burr traveled west and was accused then later by Thomas Jefferson of conspiring to set up a whole new nation out of Spanish territories. So it seems like that duel, that argument, just led straight into yet another big national rift.
Yet another duel. I mean, Burr headed west after shooting Hamilton. And then in 1805, rumors reached Washington of a plot to make Burr emperor of a new nation cut out of Mexico and the American West. And Jefferson concluded he was guilty and made sure that Burr was charged. And again, this is the former vice president was charged with treason.
What a tangled, complicated history. I mean, what wound up happening to Burr in the end?
Well, here perhaps is another sign of perspective that the founders can give us. In his last days, Burr was reading the novel Tristram Shandy, and this is a novel in which a character is tormented by a fly, and he catches it, and he lets it go, saying, "This world is surely wide enough to hold both thee and me." And Burr's almost last words, according to his 19th century biographer, were, "I should have known that the world was wide enough for Hamilton and me." So perhaps Burr deserves some appreciation in this age where we are as divided as the founders. He was certainly an opportunist. The criticism of him as such was valid. But he did try to appeal to both Federalists and Republicans, even if it was only to advance his own ambitions. And perhaps, as I said, that provides some lesson for us, given our own ideological divides.
Well, I was thinking that the great thing about this nation and this democracy is that no matter how heated and vicious our political battles get, especially around the time of an election, in the end, we have always managed to transfer power peacefully. And in the end, there's an inauguration, and one person stands up at that lectern and has to say something to heal the nation, to heal this divide, bring people back together, you know, reconcile people to the point that they can at least work together. What are the great moments that you think of, the people who've done that really, really well, that moment of bringing the nation back together?
I think
again,
Jefferson certainly did a wonderful job of reconciling the Federalists and the Republicans. In his inaugural address, it was very conciliatory. He reached out to both parties. Every difference of opinion is not a difference of principle, Jefferson said in his inaugural address. We are all Republicans. We are all Federalists. And perhaps that, too, is a hopeful note for today. It kind of would be nice to hear someone say, we are all Republicans. We are all Democrats. I think another wonderful example of reconciliation would be Thomas Paine and William Cobbett. Paine is fairly well known as, of course, the author of Common Sense and American Crisis. These were pamphlets that inspired Americans to independence and to revolution. Paine was too radical for most of the founders. His support for the French Revolution, his attacks on religion were just too much for most of the founders. John Adams said of Paine that he was begotten by a wild boar and a bitch wolf. And Adams also said, never before in any age of the world has there been such a career of mischief. And you would think, as insults go, that would be tough to top. But William Cobbett, another popular and aggressive writer of the time, but on the Federalist side, managed to attack Paine even more viciously. Cobbett wrote, how Tom gets a living now or in what brothel he inhabits, I know not. Like Judas, he will be remembered by posterity. Men will learn to express all that is base, malignant, treacherous, unnatural, and blasphemous by the single monosyllable, Paine. And yet, there is a reconciliation. When Cobbett returned to England, he found himself disillusioned by the corruption and inequality he saw there. And he was also not happy about being jailed there for sedition. So he turned around and decided that Paine was right about everything. And this led to one of the most remarkable stories I've heard, which is that in 1819, Cobbett stumbled through the dark in New Rochelle, where Paine was buried. And he dug up Paine's corpse with the intent of taking the bones to England so a proper monument could be built for Paine there. And at the customs inspection in Liverpool, he announced, there, gentlemen, are the mortal remains of the immortal Thomas Paine. And somehow he did manage to get them through customs. But we don't know what happened to Paine's bones. It's one of the mysteries of history. We know Cobbett's son, J.P., inherited the bones when Cobbett died in 1835, but no one knows where they are today.
Wow. Just as you think you know our history, and just as you think things today couldn't be stranger or worse, that's quite a story.
It could be just as nasty and just as strange.
Paul Aaron is a historian and the director of publications at the Colonial Williamsburg Foundation. We were talking about his book, Founding Feuds: The Rivalries, Clashes, and Conflicts That Forged a Nation. We're talking about political reconciliation, and let's make it personal. I want to introduce you to a couple whose marriage could be an example to us all. It starts like something ripped out of a terrible rom-com. She's a lifelong liberal. He's a senior editor for the Conservative National Review. This sounds like a recipe for marital disaster. And yet, Jeanie Safer and Richard Brookhiser have been happily married for more than 35 years.
We met in a singing group.
I had been a member of it for a couple of years, and then Rick joined. We sang Renaissance religious music on street corners. And he had a wonderful voice.
And so did she. And she had a great laugh.
I recognized how wonderfully he sang, and he was a charming, tall, good-looking guy. And I asked him what he did, and he said he was a writer, and that was great. And then I asked who he wrote for, and he said William Buckley at National Review, which was less great, but that's how we met.
I'm a conservative Republican, and I went to an Ivy League school. So I was already used to being among people who were mostly not of my views.
Well, it was different for me. I mean, first of all, I'm a liberal, but I really didn't know anybody like Rick. I didn't know anybody who was conservative. The conservatives for me were the John Birch Society. So I got an education, and I found to my distress and comfort that many of the people whose opinions appalled me, who were Rick's colleagues, I liked very much. And sometimes they were a lot more gracious to me than my friends who agreed with me were about him.
My conservative friends had the same view of Jeannie's charms as I had, so it was an easy sell.
The one time,
it was a cruise for my magazine, National Review, and Jeannie was seated next to Newt Gingrich, who had just become the Speaker of the House. And they got into a little tiff about George Washington, who was the subject of my first biography. And Newt was saying, "Liberals hate Washington." And Jeannie said, "No, Mr. Gingrich, liberals esteem George Washington. I do." And he said, "Liberals hate Washington." So that didn't work out very well.
Well, you know, we do avoid a great deal. And I think that's a very wise move. At a certain point in any marriage, you realize there are things you are never going to meet on. Now, they happen for us to be things like abortion, assisted suicide, gun control, etc. And we both feel passionate about these issues, but we feel more passionately about our relationship and the things we have in common.
What we like to read, what we like to listen to, the kind of places we want to live, that's very similar, always has been.
Also, his political analysis is fascinating, and he's a superb writer. So there's, you know, we obviously focus on the things that work, but there's an awful lot that works. We don't have to labor at that at this point.
Well, I'll tell you another thing. One way that gets you over the bumps is to take a step back and analyze what's happening. I mean, instead of, like, grabbing each other's throats and going at the issue, you can say, "Ah, well, your side really played that badly," or, "My side really had an own goal, didn't they?" You know, you can always do that.
This year we're having a delightful time of it, I have to say, because it's so ghastly on both sides that we're building up capital for the future, I would say. And, you know, you do have to have a sense of humor, but you also have to have a basic notion that you really are not going to change your mate's politics any more than you're going to change many fundamental things about that person. You know, you really don't ask the party registration of the person who's helping you when you're getting chemotherapy. And we both had that experience. So what really counts is your character. And politics, alas, does not define good character.
Let me disagree with you on that. Politics is important. It's very important. But it's not the only thing that's very important. There are many other things. Life is complicated.
But let me disagree with you that politics is important. But in a marriage, goodwill is more important and appreciating the underlying things about the other person. Because there are plenty of things that every couple in the world who has a long marriage have disagreed with passionately about.
I have made you more civic-minded. I mean, because of me, you vote in every election, which you didn't used to do. But now you know you've got to go out and cancel that vote of mine. So I've made you a better citizen.
Yes, I vote in every single election, and I expect Rick to vote too. I would never say that he shouldn't, because being a conservative is really part of who he is. And I love him with all of that, and I don't even call it a warts and all at this point. It's part of his character, part of his seriousness, part of his intellect, and it's a package deal for me.
Jeannie Safer and Richard Brookhiser. Jeannie's a psychologist and the author of The Golden Condom and other essays on love, lost, and found. Richard's a senior editor of the National Review. His most recent book is Founder's Son, A Life of Abraham Lincoln. And coming up, jazz performer Esperanza Spalding on how to reconcile through improvisation. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Today we're talking about reconciliation, how to recover personal and political harmony. And here's jazz performer Esperanza Spalding on what a lifetime of improvising has taught her about reconciliation.
As any seasoned improviser will tell you, you always kind of reach the limit of what you've practiced.
I want to find what's actually there. Like, I want to find out why I feel uncomfortable with that drummer. I want to go into that. I want to go into the, like, blah, discomfort and the yuck, and I want to go right into the middle of it with them, and I want us to be brave enough to hear what that sounds like and unpackage it and reveal it and even look like jerks if we need to and show what it is. Where's the conflict coming from? And then how can we co-create with that? You can't do it by yourself. That's the crazy thing. You have to, in that moment, be willing to leap out past your ability and go like, okay, I'm going to start on this sound. And you start to play in that direction. And what happens, all of a sudden, a context rises to meet you. And that phenomenon, what I just described, we will have to apply off the bandstand to create more coherence. The other day, we were talking about democracy, talking about, like, where do we want to see our union? And I realized, like, actually, the challenge for me, anyway, is, like, figuring out how to reconcile with the other. As we know, if you've ever been a part of an entity that votes for anything, like, on PTA or in a band or where you want to go have dinner, just because you won, just because what you wanted to happen happened, people you disagree with don't just disappear. You all have to go to that dinner together. You know, half people don't really want to be there. So then what's your responsibility to that 49%? I get into a rehearsal room and I have to confront these challenges of my wants and my intentions with other people's wants and intentions. And the same sensation is triggered when, let's say, I'm at a coffee shop and start to have a conversation with somebody that sees things really differently. And they're my neighbor and I'm gonna see them every day. And we're gonna have to find a common ground because they're not gonna go away. Whatever happens with this election or any election, we live with each other. Our futures are tied up with each other because we're both voting in the same city. It like activates a similar kind of defense mechanism, a similar kind of hunger for finding our commonality, you know? That's the area we can push, just like on the stage in the improv. Like, okay, I know when it gets diminished or up-tempo, I start to fall off. So that's what I gotta practice.
Jazz performer Esperanza Spalding. Her latest album is Emily's D-plus Evolution. So sounds like politics could learn something from the arts, namely that conflict can be creative and generative. Steve Paulson's been reading The Art of Rivalry by art critic Sebastian Smee. It's the story of the intense conflicts that fueled some of the most dramatic breakthroughs in modern art. For instance, in the early 1900s, a young Spanish painter named Pablo Picasso arrived in Paris and started trying to make a name for himself. But there was another artist that everybody was already talking about, a man 10 years older named Henri Matisse.
He had an amazing sort of manner, Matisse. He was very convincing. He was very good at talking about his own work. And even though it looked crazy to most people, because he was painting in such a wild and rough-looking style, he was very good at explaining what he was doing and convinced many people. It was more difficult for Picasso at this stage, not only because he was younger, but because he didn't have a good grasp of French. And, you know, he's watching what Matisse is doing. He's trying to be experimental and quite avant-garde himself, but everything Matisse does seems to be one step ahead of him, sort of wilder, more daring, and he's better at explaining it. So I think at this point it was an incredibly galling kind of thing for Picasso to be dealing with.
You know, did they both know they were competing with each other?
That's a great question. I think Picasso felt very conscious of competing with Matisse, and you can see that in the way that he adopts all these, you know, new ideas and new methods from Matisse. But I suspect that Matisse wasn't quite so aware that he was in a kind of rivalry. And I think it took him a while before he realized that he was in a real battle. You know, at that point where Picasso really tries to push away and hurry on and form his own artistic identity, at which point he paints the Demoiselle d'Avignon, which is the famous work now in the Museum of Modern Art. And then from there, with Braque, who had been Matisse's friend and fellow fauvist, they invent Cubism together, Picasso and Braque. So Braque has defected, if you like, from Matisse to Picasso's side. So it all gets very complicated, and I think it's only at that point that Matisse becomes aware that he really has a serious rival on his hands.
Now, are you saying that Picasso's revolutionary work, Les Demoiselles d'Avignon, is to some degree a product of having watched Matisse and sort of feeling like he had to one-up Matisse?
There's no doubt about it. You know, you can see it really on the canvas. I mean, one of the more obvious instances of this, apart from the fact that we know he'd seen Matisse's Blue Nude, apart from that, he'd also seen some African sculptures that Matisse had showed him. And he listened to what Matisse was saying, and then he went away. And it's not so long after that that he repaints a part of this huge canvas he's working on, the Demoiselle d'Avignon, and puts two African-style masks on the faces of two of the five figures in that painting.
Now, were they friends, or were they more just sort of, I don't know, they'd go to each other's studios and look at each other's art? I mean, how far did the relationship go?
You know, in a sense, The relationship kind of went in and out of friendship. At times, I think it really was quite pointed and charged with a kind of rivalry. But then it would go back into sort of mutual admiration and friendship. And there was a period there during the First World War where we hear about them going horse riding together. And they would exchange works and inquire after one another's family. So there really was a closeness there, and Matisse would even, you know, recommend Picasso to important collectors. So it went beyond rivalry into something that was much more complex, and, you know, maybe the word frenemies, which we use a lot these days, is the best way to describe it.
Well, let's talk about another one of your rivalries that you write about between the two 19th century Impressionists, Manet and Degas, who also had a fraught friendship, and there was this remarkable moment when Manet actually destroyed a portrait that Degas had painted. Can you explain what happened?
Yes, it's really extraordinary. I went to Japan to rather obscure museum there to see it, and it really is a gorgeous thing. But you think, my word, what actually happened there? What an extraordinary thing for one friend, a gifted artist who, according to everyone, was incredibly affable and everyone seemed to love him. How strange that he felt compelled to take a knife to this canvas. But there was conflict and there was jealousy and all sorts of things going on in their relationship at that time. And apart from that, you know, Manet was going through a very difficult time in his own career, whereas Degas, who had been profoundly influenced by Manet, was at this stage really on the up and up. And I think that changing dynamic must have affected things as well.
So was this another case where each other's art kind of spurred the other one on? I mean, the rivalry?
I think so. And, you know, after their brief falling out over that slashed painting, Degas said about Manet, it's impossible to remain enemies for long. they patched things up. I don't think things were ever quite the same, but you get a sense, a bit like with Matisse and Picasso, of them looking at each other over the next decade or so before Manet died. And if Degas painted a horse track, Manet would paint a horse track, but in a different way. If Degas painted women trying on hats in a shop, then Manet would try that himself. And so it did work both ways, and it's fascinating to trace the mutual influence.
And you say that after Manet died, even though, you know, he had destroyed this painting that Degas had given him, that Degas became an avid collector of Manet's work.
He really did, and I found that so moving. I'd never really realized the extent of the collection of works by Manet that he had. He collected other artists as well, but you had a feeling that in doing so, he was sort of keeping Manet close to him and in a way trying to compensate for not only for the loss of Manet, his friend, but for what went wrong between them as a result of this rivalry.
Now, what's interesting in both of these rivalries we've talked about so far, they weren't just bitter rivals, you know, trying to dismiss each other. There was real intimacy as well in their friendships, and which means that there are periods of openness, of vulnerability to each other.
Absolutely. And I'm so glad you bring that up, because that was a feeling that most interested me. I really wasn't interested in writing a story about macho guys butting heads. You know, it is about male rivalry, but it is much more yielding, as you say, and open. And, you know, Matisse said it beautifully when he said, you know, I've never been afraid of the influence of others. He said, I would have considered it a cowardice and a betrayal of myself if I had been afraid to take on influence. And I think that's so admirable, and something that, you know, maybe we all need to think about in our lives. When we have enemies or rivalries, it's worth thinking about what we can learn from them and taking on board that influence. Because it's usually when, you know, we feel threatened that we feel that way.
Well, the other thing that played out in all of these rivalries that you've described is the friendships all suffered at certain points. I mean, there were rocky times. Sometimes they sort of never were really able to repair them. And I guess I wonder if when you were competing at the highest levels, you know, you're very close to another artist and then you want to best that other artist, is it possible to stay friends?
That's a great question. But I think, you know, the evidence is yes. You know, to talk about Matisse and Picasso again, you know, the fact that they did, I mean, the tension between them around 1908, 1910, when Cubism is being invented and Picasso really does overtake Matisse in terms of renown and the interest of critics and collectors and all the crucial people, it suddenly switched in a way that must have been so disorienting for Matisse. It all switched to Picasso. And yet, they managed to remain friends. As I said, it went in and out, but they were looking at each other's work. They were incredibly respectful and often fond of each other for long periods after that. And it was the same, you know, with the other artists. Degas and Manet patched things up, you know, and it's a testament, I think, to, you know, the largeness of spirit that all of these artists in different ways had. I mean, we tend to look at the lives of many of these great artists and despair because we think, oh my God, the bohemian cliches and the self-destruction and the sort of narcissism often, or the selfishness, the wreckage they left behind in their personal lives. It's all true in a way, but I think we forget what it really does take to be truly original and truly great. You know, it's easy to patronize it. It's harder to really get to grips with what it would be like to be there out on a limb. Because of the sort of psychic cost of that, I think that relationships with other artists that you really admire become very important.
Boston Globe art critic Sebastian Smee, he's the author of The Art of Rivalry, Four Friendships, Betrayals, and Breakthroughs in Modern Art. Steve Paulson was talking with him. And coming up, writer Jacqueline Woodson on growing up in Brooklyn and her new novel. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now, Bookmarks, writers on books they love.
Hi, my name is Tom Kunkel. I am the author of Man in Profile, Joseph Mitchell of The New Yorker. The book I want to recommend to you is called Here is New York by E.B. White. Here is New York is one of the smallest books about New York City, but there's no question in my mind that it is absolutely one of the best. E.B. White was someone who worked for The New Yorker magazine for much of his life. He was one of the first people in the door when The New Yorker was founded, and was one of the people that was really incredibly inspirational, helped shape the magazine that we came to know and still know to this day. In the early 1990s, I was researching a biography of Harold Ross, who founded The New Yorker. And I'm thinking, all these people landed in New York in the mid-20s, but none of them were from New York. How did they know what they were supposed to be doing with a magazine that presumed to tell people, smart people, about New York and what was cool and interesting about it? And I was really having a hard time in my research trying to answer that question myself when I stumbled across Here is New York. It was as if someone had handed me a key to unlock this great mystery. I was so thankful to E.B. White, and I learned later that many people felt the same way. It's just this phenomenally fun, insightful piece. Even now, even though it's almost 70 years old, if you read it today, you'll have such a strong sense of how New York works. One of the main things that E.B. White lays out in the book is that there really are three New Yorks. The first New York is that of the natives, and they give it this sort of blasé solidity. And the second New York is that of the commuters who come in from the suburbs. They see New York every day, but only really narrow slivers of it. But it is the third aspect of New York, the settlers, that really give New York its passion and its spirit and its driving force. And these are people precisely like the Harold Rosses and the James Thurbers of the world who came to New York from other places. And they were so dazzled by it. And they were so fascinated by it. And they were so curious about it that they were just awestruck. And it finally dawned on me that the reason, in many ways, the New Yorker worked from the start is because these people were exploring their own curiosity about New York in the magazine every week. New York's been something of a second home to me ever since, and I continue to be just amazed by how insightful E.B. White is about this complicated city.
Thomas Kunkel recommends Here is New York by E.B. White. You'll find more bookmarks on our website at ttbook.org. This month, the National Book Awards will announce this year's winners, and among the finalists is Jacqueline Woodson's novel, Another Brooklyn. It's her first new adult novel in decades, though you might remember that she won a National Book Award for her young adult memoir, Brown Girl Dreaming. This new novel is the story of a friendship among four girls in the Bushwick neighborhood in the 1970s. That's where Woodson herself grew up. She told Steve Paulson that this kind of black girl narrative didn't exist when she was younger. This is the kind of book she always wanted to read. So here's an excerpt from the beginning of Another Brooklyn.
If we had had jazz, would we have survived differently? If we had known our story was a blues with a refrain running through it, would we have lifted our heads, said to each other, "This is memory," again and again until the living made sense? Where would we be now if we had known there was a melody to our madness? Because even though Sylvia, Angela, Gigi, and I came together like a jazz improv, half notes tentatively moving toward one another until the ensemble found its footing and the music felt like it had always been playing, we didn't have jazz to know this was who we were. We had the top 40 music of the 1970s trying to tell our story. It never quite figured us out.
That is a great setup. Thank you. Jacqueline, what does the title of your book, Another Brooklyn, refer to?
So Another Brooklyn refers to a number of things. First and foremost, it's the Brooklyn of another time. The Bushwick that is on the page here has changed drastically. And it also refers to the girls looking for a way out, exits from their current existence.
So what was that time in Brooklyn then, in the Bushwick neighborhood?
So in the 1970s, there was white flight going on. White folks were moving out to Long Island and Queens, upstate to Westchester. And black and Latino people were moving in through the Great Migration and through immigration. And then it settled into a black and Latino neighborhood that was considered by people on the outside urban, ghetto, slum, whatever the words of that period were. And it was one of the things I wanted to explore in the book was gazing from the inside, because so much of the narrative around that place at that time was an outsider's gaze, and it wasn't our truth.
What was the neighborhood like when you lived there as a kid?
Bushwick was amazing. It was alive. There were people coming back from Vietnam, so there was that kind of change. There was, of course, you know, heroin, because people brought that back from Vietnam, sadly. There were lots of kids in the neighborhood. There was this freedom that we had because everyone really looked out for each other. So there were much fewer cars, so kids played in the streets and it was safe. There was this deep respect for children and children's games and the way children needed to be in the world that I don't feel like exist as much anymore.
Are you nostalgic for your childhood?
For my childhood, I don't want to go back there, but I want it remembered.
Well, in your story, in Another Brooklyn, your narrator, August, meets three girls, and they become best friends. And you have a passage where I think it's the moment of introduction, in a way. Mm-hmm. Could you read that?
Mm-hmm. The school bell was ringing. All around us, children were running toward the entrance. Sylvia took my hand. "You belong to us now," she said. And for so many years, it was true. "What did you see in me?" I'd ask years later. "Who did you see standing there?" "You look lost," Gigi whispered. "Lost and beautiful." "And hungry," Angela added. "You looked so hungry." And as we stood half circle in the bright schoolyard, we saw the lost and beautiful and hungry in each of us. We saw home.
So the picture, at least for a good chunk of the book, is it's kind of a beautiful view of childhood, and particularly the friendship among these four girls. I mean, they're all smart and talented, and the world is just full of possibility mm-hmm. ahead of them. How would you describe these girls?
Exactly as you did. When they're with each other, they create this kind of human shield that allows them to be who they are in their world safely.
And this is—and how old are they when they first meet?
When they first meet, they're in grade school, so they're around fifth or sixth grade. Mm-hmm. And when they finally start realizing they're kind of on the edge of adolescence, they begin to realize how much more they need each other, how they need that kind of bond and human shield that they become for each other. At one point, I talk about how boys didn't understand girls together. They understood girls alone, you know, hiding their chest, praying for invisibility. And with each other, they allow themselves to be very visible in the world.
And probably pretty intimidating to those boys.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I mean, if it's worth pointing out that, I mean, you are best known for being a children's book writer. I mean, this one is an adult book, but is there a particular piece of childhood that you want to tell us when you write about children?
I want to talk about all of it. And, you know, at the beginning I say, what is tragic isn't the moment, it's the memory. Because once you start looking back at it from your adult perspective, you start seeing all the kind of fissures in it, right? You start seeing all the places where the veneer begins to crack. But when you're in it, you're not aware of that. You're just aware of the deep joy or the unfairness of being a child in an adult world. And as I was writing it, all of that came flooding back to me, that adult perspective that I had now, and also the deep memories of childhood.
Now, the other thing that happens in your story is as these girls become teenagers, they realize there's also a world of danger out mm-hmm. there. I mean, there are predatory men lurking around. Mm-hmm. There's the fear of pregnancy, mm-hmm. which could be disastrous for these girls in particular. Were those big issues for you and your cohort as you were growing up?
Definitely the predators, right? And I think it's the reality of every girl, because our growing up is so visible to the world, right? You see bodies developing, and it's nothing we can hide, like, and we don't want to hide it, right? We don't want to suddenly wear baggy t-shirts and have that kind of invisibility, because we're also celebrating ourselves as coming into adulthood, and there's this way in which we want to be desired, and so it is that tricky place of balance that as young as adolescent girls, you haven't quite learned yet. In terms of pregnancy, in my crew, I mean, we were some geeky girls, like in this way that we knew we weren't going to get pregnant because I think we were too afraid. I was terrified. My mom said, you know, you better not get pregnant.
And you came from a pretty religious family.
Yeah,
didn't you?
Yeah. I grew up Jehovah's Witness, but that doesn't mean I wasn't fooling around. but I knew, like, the line was drawn. If I were to get pregnant as a teenager, my life would be over.
You know, it strikes me that this world that you're describing doesn't tend to get into books. I mean, it's mm-hmm. fairly unusual literary terrain. I mean, especially the experience of being a black girl in the 70s mm-hmm. in Brooklyn. I don't know. Are there other stories like that?
Well, now there's a great book by Britt Bennett called The Mothers that explores it in actually present day. But I think of Toni Morrison's Zula, Zora Neale Hurston back in the day. But yeah, this story, I don't think a lot of people are telling it yet. And I think that black girl narrative is so rich, and I didn't grow up reading it. And it's so important to me that I needed to put it on the page.
Do you think people or communities carry history with them? I mean, I don't know. Is there sort of a collective history that's deeply embedded in us that we carry on into the present?
I believe in genetic memory. So,
what do you mean by that?
That stuff that happened to my ancestors is in my DNA. So one thing, my fear of water and people's fear of water, we call the Middle Passage Syndrome, right? Because of the slave trade and coming over and those huge bodies of water and the bottom bowels of these ships and just that fear of open bodies of water and what is on the other side of them or if you're going to make it across. Like, I think as a kid, my mom gave me swimming lessons. You know, if you put me in a pool that's 5 feet deep, I can swim across it 20 times. But if you put me in the ocean, I would probably drown. Like, I just can't, psychologically, I can't make that connection to how buoyancy works in water because of something that's deeper and older, I think. And I think a lot of, even in writing Brown Girl Dreaming, there is this way in which I feel like every time you sit down to write, the ancestors in the room helping me tell that story. So I definitely, when people don't have a connection to their past, I kind of look askance. I'm like, what happened to it? What is it you're trying to hide or forget?
Jacqueline Woodson, talking with Steve Paulson about her new novel called Another Brooklyn. That's it for this hour, but there's more in our podcast feed. To subscribe, look us up on iTunes, Stitcher, or any other podcasting app. That way you'll never miss a show. To the best of our knowledge comes to you from Madison, Wisconsin, and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. Raymond Tongakar produced this hour, with help from Doug Gordon and Charles Monroe Kane. Our theme music is from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer, and I'm Anne Strainchamps. Until next time.
PRI, Public Radio International.